Hello, welcome to the first episode of Don't Shoplift the Pootie from Shyamalan.
Yeah, you did it!
This is a reference to a line from the 1996 film Jerry Maguire, in which Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character advises Tom Cruise's character to fully commit to his relationship with a single mother by saying, "Don't shoplift the Pootie from a single mom."
That's so true.
Luke, can you explain what it means in the context of this show?
I think the bullshit explanation I came up with was that the non-committal relationship to M. Night Shyamalan is everyone that watched The Sixth Sense and liked it, and then shit all over every other movie he ever made. You gotta commit yourself to M. Night Shyamalan. He makes good movies.
People like this one.
People are, like, okay on this one.
I think this got a somewhat tepid reception at the time, but I see a lot of people saying, like, oh, this is his best movie. This is one of the best movies ever made.
I think there are people that are, like, way in the tank for it. I think the overall level of enthusiasm is lower, though.
I gotta say, I don't really understand why someone would like this movie but not, like, Old or The Happening.
Yeah, I will admit to not having seen Old or The Happening.
He's kind of been doing the same thing.
Yeah. It is weird looking back how quickly, like, the public turned on M. Night Shyamalan.
Was The Village when they turned?
I think The Village is when it started. I think everyone, you know, went fucking crazy over The Sixth Sense for good reason. That's an incredible movie. Then they, you know, this came out and people were like, okay, you know, it's no Sixth Sense, but sure. And then, like, Signs came out, and people were really excited for it, but I think some people were like, what's with this fucking ending? This is kind of lame. And then, like, that sentiment continued to build through The Village. And then, is The Happening or Lady in the Water first?
Lady in the Water's first.
So Lady in the Water, that one's a bit of a problem.
It's a bit of a dud?
Have you seen that one yet?
No.
I'll admit I haven't seen it since I was a teenager, but, you know, it's not the best movie I've ever seen.
I know it's about Paul Giamatti is like an apartment superintendent or something. He finds a lady in the water and M. Night Shyamalan's going to write a book that saves the world.
Right. So the lady in the water he finds is like a sea nymph from a world of fantasy who is here to be the muse for a writer that will create a book that saves the world, who is played by M. Night Shyamalan, which, you know, maybe don't cast yourself as the artist with such a perfect singular vision that it'll save society. For maybe people might take that as arrogant.
Isn't that the same thing as this movie?
M. Night Shyamalan plays a drug dealer in this movie.
Yeah, but, like, Elijah is gonna make David Dunn the superhero.
Yeah, a little bit. They're both definitely like, oh, society needs fixed by a guy.
By a security guard with psychic powers.
Yeah. And, like, you know, Lady in the Water is very concerned with, like, storytelling, like, tropes, especially, like, fairy tale tropes. And I guess in a similar way to this movie also, with this one's comic book tropes.
Yeah. Or, like, The Happening is, like, old B-movies like The Blob.
Right. Yeah. Because, yeah, Lady in the Water, it's very, like, well, there's some sort of, like, wolf creatures. I think they're called Skrunts. That are hunting for the nymph, whose name is Story, of course.
I know the scene where they eat the critic, who's like, this is so unrealistic.
Well, right. He, like, walks into a room with a scrunt, and then he turns and stares into the camera and says, this is the part of the movie where, like, such and such would happen. However, since the... Or is, like, this is the part of the movie where a character such as mine might get, like, you know, violently killed. However, since this isn't an R-rated movie, I think I might be okay. And then he dies. I think he literally calls out the age rating of the movie.
People liked it when Scream did that.
You know? People liked it when... Maybe Lady in the Water is due for a reevaluation.
I'm saying. We're in the Shyamalan Renaissance.
There's no way to combine those two words. Or maybe there is, but then I thought about the fucking decades of people doing really lazy, vaguely racist wordplay with M. Night Shyamalan's name and decided to think better of it.
Right.
Yeah. I watched Unbreakable last night, and I had seen it before, but not in a long time, and I'll tell you, coming after Zack Snyder's Justice League, it was just like a refreshing drink of water.
Shyamalan is easily the best director we have covered.
That might be true. Yeah. Yeah, I guess who would even really give him a run for his money on that?
No one.
Yeah, no one. Is this the first movie we've covered that was... No, Jerry Maguire. I was going to say, is this the first movie that we've covered that was shot on film?
Batman.
Yeah, Batman also. That's true.
Spider-Man was shot on film.
Okay, yeah, I'm just forgetting. You're right. I just, as soon as I, like, pulled it up and, like, oh, this is a film.
I think maybe even Iron Man was shot on film.
Was it?
2008? It could have been shot on film.
Well, now we gotta find out. Yeah, no, you're right. Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, and Thor were all filmed.
All right, there you go.
Not taped, yeah. Okay, well, shows what I know. I just know that as soon as the fucking first scene came up and, like, I could see, like, film grain, I was like, oh, I'm in it now. Oh, let's fucking go.
So you enjoyed this film?
So what I'll say, I went fucking bananas for maybe the first half to two-thirds of it. The ending of it started to lose me a little.
Why is that?
Part of it is just this movie is very slow and quiet and sad. And again, for most of the runtime, I fucking loved that about it. It did make my attention start to wander eventually. And I also think part of it is there's just some stuff about how that last act goes that doesn't really work for me as well as the earlier parts did. I wish it was a little more ambiguous whether David Dunn had superpowers.
Why is that?
I think it would be more interesting for me personally if it was more about, like, I'm trying to think of the most succinct way to explain the way that I'm thinking about this. Mr. Glass, a great character, who I love to see, even though he's a bastard man, is, like, the shittiest kind of comic book nerd, right? Where he's just, like, he doesn't even have any joy out of it. Like, his art gallery is, like, gray and white, and he doesn't have any color drawings anywhere in it.
Right.
When color is such an important part of superheroes, but no. That's some bullshit to him. And he is so, like, single-mindedly obsessed with, like, not just looking at the world through the lens of superhero comics, but trying to force the world to behave more like a superhero comic. And I kind of wish, early on, David expresses, like, the feeling that Mr. Glass is just a con man who's trying to gas him up for some reason. And I almost sort of wish that you could spend more of the movie really wondering if that is what's going on here. Does David actually have super strength, or is he just such a, like, kind of broken, sad man that he doesn't recognize that he is, like, he's stronger than he thinks he is? But when he's lifting 350 pounds without any, like, real strength training, okay, no, he's really superpowered. You know, does he have, like, empathic visions of every sin committed by a person he touches? Or is he just, like, a security guard with good instincts? No, he literally has visions of, like, you know, when he touches people. I wish there was a little bit more. Is Mr. Glass right that this is, like, there are, like, you know, gods and superheroes among us that don't even know it? Or is that just him trying to, like, impose his worldview on the world, you know?
Right.
I think that would be, like, a more interesting version of this story to me.
If I'm thinking through his filmography, I don't think Shyamalan ever really trades in that kind of ambiguity. He's always, like, taking the concept very literally.
Yeah. And I mean, and I have not seen Glass, but I know part of that is that David ends up in an, like, insane asylum with Mr. Glass, and, like, the therapist is trying to convince them that they're crazy and there are no, like, superpowers. And, like, kind of, like, starts to convince them. And, like, no, I've watched Unbreakable. I saw every time Bruce Willis touched somebody and then, like, had a perfect vision of all the evil things they did.
Except for one time he was wrong about the drugs.
Yeah, see, and, like, oh, I like that because, again, like, I like the... You could have the visions if he was not dead on every time but that one time, right? Like, if there was the ambiguity of, is he having psychic visions or is he writing a little story in his head about this person, and maybe it's right more often than it's wrong just because, again, he has good instincts or whatever, you know?
Right.
Like, when Mr. Glass sees the gun that the guy has, David points out, like, okay, guns come in two colors. I had a 50-50 shot about being right about it. But, like, that's not he says that line, but it's like the last denial of somebody who's clearly wrong, rather than someone pointing out that, like, there's mundane explanations for this stuff.
Yeah, I would say I really like this on a filmmaking level. I think
Shyamalan... On a filmmaking level, kind of impeccable.
Yes, Shyamalan's a fantastic director. Yeah. As a story, it felt a little, I don't know, straightforward. Like, this is just a superhero origin story in the way you would expect it to go.
Yeah, kinda.
And I don't know what more I was expecting exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused about the... His marriage is failing because he has the not being a superhero depression.
Well, I think that works in the sense that just, like, if I pull out to, like, a metaphorical level of it, it's just, like, he feels unfulfilled and, like, he's deeply depressed and his, like, relationships are deteriorating because of it. And, like, that's, you know, literalized in this movie as, like, it's not just he needs to embrace, like, his best self or, like, follow his dreams or whatever more. Just, no, you need to start, like, being a superhero and saving people from house invasion movies.
Right.
That's the other thing, too, I don't love about that third act is how just... That's a really over-the-top thing for him to stumble into, you know?
It's a supervillain.
It's a supervillain, and again, like... I like the idea more of the version of this movie where it's just the normal world, but it's being, like, forced into a certain framing, much like the characters are forced into a certain framing by the film itself, and, like, having him just be, like, just a fucking, like, monster serial killer instead of something that's a little more, like, commonplace just kind of pushes it into territory that I didn't really want to see the movie go.
I wonder if that guy will come back in Glass.
You know?
Because if Superman is supposed to be an exaggeration of people who are kind of strong and tough.
Right.
I guess the Joker is an exaggeration of that guy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the movie.
It opens on title cards about comic books.
There are 35 pages and 124 illustrations in the average comic book. I don't think that's true.
You know, I don't know comic books well enough to...
Maybe if you count the ads.
Sure.
A single issue ranges in price from $1 to over $140,000. 172,000 comics are sold in the U.S. every day, over 62,780,000 each year. The average comic collector owns 3,312 comics and will spend approximately 1 year of his or her life reading them. Is that the average?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a lot. That means there's people with way more.
Yeah, I mean, is it that... What's he calling a comic collector, you know?
Right.
Is somebody that, like, has a pull list at their shop because they like to read it, like, you know, Power Girl every month? Is that a comic collector, or is that just, you know, a casual?
If I have, like, a shelf with some comics, am I a comic collector?
Right. What do you think is, like... Why is this here? What does this mean?
This is who Mr. Glass is. He's the guy who reads comics all day.
No, totally. But, like, why do you think we're focusing so much on, like, hey, here's how many comics get printed and read and that, like, boy, they sell for so much money. Like, why is that the first thing the movie wants to tell you, do you think?
It establishes that comic books are an important element of our culture.
Yeah. The thing that kind of hit me watching it this time is it's very, like, I think part of it, too, we're watching this movie in 2024 when comic books have fully taken over pop culture, right?
Right.
And it feels a little bit like, yeah, no, you know, you don't realize how many of these things are, like, manufactured and distributed and how many people are reading them and how much they're reading them. And, like, it makes this movie feel weirdly, like, prescient to me.
Right.
Like, you don't even fucking know what's coming down the pike, man.
But I guess it establishes if the audience is unfamiliar with the comics industry, hey, yeah, they make and sell a lot of comics. This is big business. This is why he can run a store that's selling comics.
Yeah. And then we get this opening scene. We're in a back room of a department store looking at a bunch of people, like, milling around. And then we realize we're looking at their reflection, and then we realize we're looking at their reflection in a reflection.
Because we only see him through glass.
We only see Mr. Glass through glass. This is the day Mr. Glass was born.
Even when he was born,
he was associated with glass.
That's so true. And yeah, it's kind of doing like, you know, the reason for the mirror is so they can do like a shot reverse shot with the doctor without like actually cutting ever.
Yeah.
Which there's like not a lot of cuts in this movie. There's a lot of long takes.
Yeah, I did notice that.
Yeah.
Because I've been playing Halo Infinite, which tries to present itself as one long take.
Yeah.
Kind of for no reason, to no effect. And then I watch this movie, it's like, oh, he's like a real filmmaker.
Right. It's funny to see, the video game touchstone I'm thinking of is Metal Gear Solid 5, which also tries to do like the long dialogue scenes in one take. But the way it like emulates a shot reverse shot is just the camera looks at one character and then whip pans around to look at the other character and then just keeps doing that.
It's so dumb.
It's so dumb. People say Kojima should direct a
movie?
It's so silly that I think it's kind of charming. But yeah, this woman, do we know Mrs. Glass's name? Mama Glass's name?
I think she's just called Mrs. Price.
We have his real last name, right? Yeah. Mrs. Price like gave birth in the back of this department store and they ran to get a doctor.
can I just say that Mr. Price would also be a good villain name?
Yeah, also a good name. That sounds like a bad guy from a Remedy game. But they ran and got a doctor, and he's like takes the baby to inspect it and is immediately freaked the fuck out because it has like all four of its limbs are broken. And he's like, oh god, like who handled this baby? Who did this? Like, did someone drop him? And, you know, everyone's like, what are you talking about? No, he just came right out. And, you know, it's scary.
Yeah, it cuts from that line to James Newton Howard's excellent score.
Yeah, yeah. And, we meet our main character, Bruce Willis, David Dunn, on that fateful Eastrail 177.
And one of the things this movie loves to do is find excuses to frame him vertically, like a comic book panel.
Yeah, characters, David especially, but lots of characters get, like, framed, like, either through a window, in a reflection, between, like, you know, seats. Like, in this, like, people are constantly boxed in by the frame.
Like a comic book.
Like a comic book, but also, perhaps David Dunn is boxed off from the rest of the world.
He feels isolated from the rest of the world.
Perhaps the cinematography informs the character arc.
Yeah.
Wild.
Even if you watch this on mute, you could get some sense of the character and story.
I feel like some people think this kind of like really like obvious sort of like cinema trick, I guess, is like too on the nose, or like it's like, ah, no, if you did it right, you wouldn't even notice that the camera was doing stuff. I like it when I notice that the camera's doing stuff.
Yeah, me too. That's what good filmmaking is.
I like it when I'm like, oh, this camera got put in this spot for a reason, and like this shot got composed in a way for a reason. I don't know. I don't necessarily want it to just feel invisible. Like I'm just in the scene. I'm looking at an image.
Yeah, I like thinking about it.
Yeah, because they also, like, sort of justify why it's using this weird framing, because it is the POV of a little kid in the seat in front of Bruce Willis, kind of, like, just sort of sitting wrong in her chair watching him.
Kids love superheroes.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, a woman comes and sits down next to David, and this movie immediately does your favorite thing, which is infidelity.
That's right. He sees her midriff tattoo and takes off his wedding ring.
He just sort of, yeah, slips his wedding ring off and, like, just starts trying to strike up a conversation with her. And it is the saddest attempt to hit on a person. He sounds... Bruce Willis's performance in this movie is that every single line, it sounds like he might start crying the next line.
He's got the not being a superhero depression.
Right, right. Even at once he's a superhero, like when he's like, you know, fixed his relationship with his wife and they're at the dinner, the you know, kitchen table holding hands in the morning, he still sounds like he's about to start crying.
Yeah.
He's just a very, like, wounded deer of a man.
Just like Spider-Man.
Yeah, and he's just very like, you moving to Philadelphia? You like sports? Oh, football, huh? Oh,
she got Jerry Maguire's job.
Yeah, she's got Jerry Maguire's job. And yeah, he just keeps like asking her questions. She's being friendly, but eventually he's like, so how long are you going to be in town for? And she like shows him her wedding ring. She's clearly very uncomfortable. He's like, Oh no, I think you misunderstood me. I wasn't trying to hit on you or anything like that.
He's such a bad liar.
Yeah.
She correctly picks up the vibe on him, just like he is able to do when touching someone's hand.
That's so true. But yeah, she just gets up and finds a different seat, and then the train just starts, like, you know, the lights start flickering, something wrong's happening.
Starts going too fast.
And then we just sort of cut away to a different scene because, listen, train crashes cost a lot of money. We're not filming that shit.
Yeah.
David's son is at home just watching TV and sees on the news that, like, his dad's train derailed. It was this horrible crash.
And he's hanging upside down, almost as if this home has been turned upside down.
Yeah, totally. And like from there, it goes to David waking up in the hospital. He's like framed between curtains again. And then even that is framed even further by like a doctor operating on somebody like all the way in the foreground, kind of out of focus.
Yeah, the whole time he's having this conversation with the doctor, you can see the guy on the table dying.
Yeah, like you're hearing a little bit of like, you know, muted dialogue about doctors trying to help this guy. You can tell it's not good, but, you know, you can't really see enough of him to even really know what part of his body you're looking at, necessarily. But then near the end of the scene, just, like, you see red start to spread out across the bandages.
Yeah, because it turns out David was the only survivor. And not only that,
everybody died on the train except him.
And not only that, but somehow he doesn't have a scratch on him.
Yeah. Which I feel like now and then you'll read, like, especially, like, from history, weird stories about this kind of thing happening, right?
That's just proof that superheroes live in our world.
Right, or again, if you were going the more ambiguous route, it's like, yeah, this is incredibly unlikely, but it does happen once in a blue moon.
Yeah, and then the stories would get exaggerated into Superman.
Right, right. And yeah, he kind of, like, walks out of the waiting room, and, like, the waiting room is just full of, like, families that almost seem like they kind of resent him for being the only one that can walk away.
Yeah, no one's outright, like, confronting him, but they're giving him looks.
Yeah, just, you can see the expressions of their faces, like, you know, just, it's not fair that this guy is okay and their loved ones aren't.
But his family comes and gives him a big hug.
Yeah. Yeah, God, their home is just the saddest place on earth.
Why is that?
It's just so, like, dimly lit, and David just kind of, like, tromping around it like a ghost.
Like a ghost, you say?
Hey now. Hey, wait a second now.
Right, the first thing he does when he gets home is he eats some cereal very slowly. Not even eating, it's just like holding the spoon over a bowl of cereal in the dark kitchen.
Yeah, well, the rest of his family is home in like different rooms. And yeah, like he bumps into his wife who asks him, you know, how the job interview went. We find out the reason he was on that train is that they are in the process of separating and he's going to move to New York and get a new job. But he thinks he flunked this interview, so it might take a little longer than he planned and she might have to put up with him for a little bit more.
I really like the dynamic between them.
Yeah, say more.
I think Robin Wright is a very good actor at selling, like, an amicable divorce.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, like, she doesn't want to divorce him. She wants him to, like, wake up as a human being and, like, you know, be her husband. But since he won't do that, she's like, well, then I guess we need to stop because this isn't sustainable.
Right.
I can't handle this anymore. And yeah, I mean, sort of half joked about it, but honestly, their relationship plays pretty much the same as Bruce Willis's marriage in The Sixth Sense, where he's a ghost who his wife can't hear.
It also plays the same as, like, superheroes who lie to their wives.
That's true. But he's not even, like, I mean, he tried to cheat on her and, like, completely blew it, but It's not even like he's living any kind of double life. He's just, he has all the like difficulty and misery of a secret identity without any benefit.
But at the end, he's living a double life because he doesn't tell her that he's Superman.
Oh, sure. At the very end. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're going through the classic tropes.
Yep. And then, yeah, David is a security guard that works at a, like, baseball stadium for, like, a university. And he is, like, coming out of work, and there's a little envelope on his windshield labeled limited edition. And he opens it up, and I, like, jump out of my chair pumping my fist because I wasn't really thinking about just how muted the color palette of this movie was until the purple lining of this envelope completely just, like, punches through all of it.
Elijah is a very stylish guy.
He's a very stylish guy, and yeah, just the way the movie is colored, just he wears a lot of purple, and every time you see his purple, it is just like the most vibrant purple you can imagine in comparison to the world around him.
It's a very good contrast with David Dunn's sad life.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. David Dunn, who later in the movie will say, "Well, my favorite color is rust."
But that, no, that's good, because his wife's favorite color is brown.
Yeah! They're made for each other! imagine Elijah hearing that conversation and be like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Pick a real color. But the envelope inside just has a note that says, have you ever been sick in your life or something?
Yeah.
Or when's the last time you got sick?
And he tells the secretary at work to ask the boss, has he ever taken any sick days? Turns out, no, he hasn't.
Yeah, and this is, again, one of those things where it's like, well, hold on. If you had never gotten sick in your entire life, you would know that. You would know that.
Unless you have the not being a superhero depression and maybe you can't remember your life too well.
But, like, your doctor would comment on something when you had a checkup. You're, like, parents would, like, think it odd that they never had to, like, keep you home from school with a cold. You never got chicken pox as a kid?
Other people might have told him that he's odd, but he just doesn't remember because he's depressed.
Yeah. Again, this is one of the things that I think would play better if Mr. Glass wasn't completely correct about everything. And it's like, no, of course he's gotten sick. It's just, if you ask me when's the last time I got sick, I couldn't really tell you. I know I have.
When's the last time you got sick?
The last time I remember getting sick is when I had COVID, but I've probably had, like, the sniffles sometime between now and then.
Mm.
But, like, I don't remember it specifically. When's the last time you got sick?
When is the last time I got sick? Maybe, like, last year? Are you unbreakable? I haven't been sick this year for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is an odd enough question that you don't think about that it could have played as like, you're kind of rewriting your own history because you want to believe Mr. Glass is right, you know?
But does he want to believe Mr. Glass is right?
On the surface, no, but I think deep down he does, yeah. Because he's, you know, he's got the superhero depression and Mr. Glass is offering him the cure.
That's true. And, you know, he's asking, he doesn't just throw away the letter. He's taking it seriously.
Yeah, exactly. Because I forget when we get this backstory exactly, but yeah, in college, David was a football player who was, like, really good, maybe could have been a pro, but he got in a car accident with his wife, then girlfriend, and hurt himself, and that, like, ruined his career prospects.
When he has the conversation with Audrey about has he ever been sick, I really like how long it drags on.
Yeah.
Because, like, she would be justified in saying, hey, it's the middle of the night, can I go back to sleep?
Yeah.
But she is, like, trying to seriously engage in this conversation like she's trying to connect to her husband.
Right, right. It's like, okay, you know what? You've initiated a conversation with me that I can't tell you the last time that happened. I guess I can't let this fish slip the line.
That's what I'm saying. Robin Wright, great actress.
And he's just like, don't you think it's weird that I've never gotten sick? She goes, no, I think it's just the middle of the night and I'm tired and can't remember the last time you had, like, a sore throat. I'm sure it's happened. Don't be weird.
Then we cut to a young Elijah Price, again framed in the reflection of a television glass.
Yes, he's just sitting alone in a room, staring at a TV that is not turned on. His arm is in a sling. Had that stylish purple all the way back in this time.
Yeah, he's got like a purple turtleneck and like an orange cardigan over it.
Yeah, and this kid just looks just pissed off at the world. Just this like bitter scowl. And his mom comes into the room and starts telling him like, you know, he can't just sit in this room all day. He's got to like live his life. You know, he's going to fall and get hurt sometimes because he's got, bone disease. But that's no excuse. He has to, you know, he can't just be afraid his whole life, Crystal.
Now, this is the origin point of all the terrible accidents, because if he had had the not being a supervillain depression, then all those people wouldn't have died. This is sort of the moral dilemma of the film.
Sure, sure. Yeah, his mom really plants all the seeds for who he becomes.
Sometimes it goes like that.
Sometimes it goes like that.
But even she says, like, well, just because you don't go outside doesn't mean you'll never fall. Like, you might fall getting up from this chair if that's what God wants. We are all bound
by fate.
Right,
if God wants you to get hurt, you're going to get hurt and there's nothing you can do about it, is what she tells him.
Right.
Which, like, wow, what a thing to tell, like, a 9-year-old.
But that, like you said, plants the seeds of his obsession with, like, everyone has a purpose in this world and we are all bound by fate.
Right, right. So she tells him that she got him a present, but it's outside across the street on a bench on the playground. And it's just, like, this vibrant purple box. She even plants the purple. She's the one that is giving him the purple.
Yeah, she raised him with a good fashion sense.
Yeah. You know, he's like, oh, what, someone's going to steal it. It's out there, like, with a bunch of kids playing. And she's like, well, you better hurry up and go get it then. And what's in that box? But an issue of Action Comics.
And that cuts straight from the cover of Action Comics to him in the future playing up the artistic value of this cover to sell to an art buyer.
Yeah, before we get into that, I do just, you know, his mom is telling him, like, I'm sorry, it's technically Active Comics. I didn't notice that last night.
Oh, that's true.
It's like a pastiche of Action Comics. But she tells him, you know, she bought a whole bunch of these, and there'll be one waiting for him outside, you know, every day. So he always has to come out and, like, be around people. And then, M. Night Shyamalan doing a little wink at the camera, she says, I hear this one has a surprise ending. but yes, as an adult, Mr. Glass he's got like an art gallery where he has a bunch of like original sketches from famous comic book artists. And he's, you know, talking a prospective buyer into, you know, about all of the artistic value of it. And I don't know if this is intentional or not. Part of what I love about Mr. Glass is that he has a just like inch deep understanding of art theory.
And he's only into superhero comics.
Like, he's showing him this drawing of a superhero punching at a villain. He's like, notice the square jaw of the hero, which represents his, like, traditional masculinity. Like, yeah, no shit, man. That's not an insightful observation.
How could a child even appreciate that one is drawn like a good guy and one is drawn like a bad guy?
Right. It's just... And, like... He is such, again, in a way that feels sort of prescient, is like, no, my dumb baby books are actually high art. They're the highest art, in fact. And if you don't appreciate that, then I should probably be allowed to hit you with my cane.
He talks about comic books broadly, but he really only means American superhero comics.
Yeah, he is not interested in, like... sequential art as a storytelling medium. He's interested in the iconography of superhero comics.
He would say that if he was into manga, he would say One Piece is the greatest story it ever told.
Right. Notice Monkey D. Luffy's round for inviting eyes. Notice Nami's accentuated breasts and narrow waist to heighten her sexuality. It's a seductive fantasy that the reader can get lost in. But yeah, this dude is like totally buying Elijah's bullshit and says like, yeah, no, okay, I'll buy it. My kid's gonna love it. I'm gonna hang it in his room. And Elijah acts like he just got spit on.
See any Teletubbies here? think this is a toy store?
Because a toy store is where you go when you buy a gift for a child. This is an art gallery. And that's a piece of art. Get the fuck out of my store.
And I like that this is the next scene after him as a child appreciating art.
Right. Right. And like connecting with, like bonding with his mom over it.
Yeah.
He is just like this, you know, he has turned his entire life into being about the thing he liked as a kid. And he wants to force the whole world to work on that paradigm. And part of what, like, I bump against with this movie is that he's completely correct to do so.
Yes.
He's, like, not wrong even a little bit.
I like that his, like you said, the gallery is all black and white, but it's also just framed copies of individual pages. There's not, like...
Yeah.
Like, if he was into sequential art, there's not a sense of a comic book is designed where you flip the pages.
Yeah, there's definitely some pages that have, like, multiple panels that he's got framed. But yeah, he never really goes that deep into comics as a storytelling medium. He just cares about, you know, you would make a superhero barrel-chested to make him look strong.
Yeah.
But after he kicks this guy out, David and his son Joshua show up to ask him about the... note that he left. And at first he's like, get the fuck out. Oh, you're that guy. Why don't you step into my office?
And they have a conversation about how David's never been injured, whereas Elijah is very easily injured.
Right. He's got, I forget what the medical term he uses, or even if that's a real medical term, but basically he was born with glass bones and paper skin, like that SpongeBob character.
Yes, he has osteogenesis imperfecta.
Yeah. He breaks his bones extremely easily, and it occurred to him that if somebody like him exists, then why shouldn't the opposite exist? Somebody who is extremely durable. Someone who might even seem supernaturally durable. Someone who might be, if you will, unbreakable.
And he has, like, Egyptian hieroglyphs behind him as he talks about how comics are an ancient way of passing history before they got commercialized.
Right, you listen, comic books that you get from a comic store, that's all bullshit. That's just watered down, you know, children's fluff. Never mind that I have a huge collection of those in my house. He also, you know, and I have no idea how much, like, M. Night Shyamalan reads comics or, like, you know, likes comics. This feels like a direct, like, Ozymandias reference, though, right? He's sitting there in a purple suit in front of, like, a tablet of Egyptian hieroglyphics.
You know what? You're right. This is Ozymandias.
Well, he basically explains his entire evil plan without admitting that it's an evil plan.
This is absolutely Ozymandias. You're right.
Yeah. And it just hit me like, yeah, hieroglyphics are the first comic book when you think about it because they're pictographs. Like, that's stupid. You're stupid.
Yeah, it's not really the same thing.
It's language. It's not... No! That's not anything! But yeah, he thinks that David Dunn may effectively be, you know, not exactly a superhero, but the kind of person that inspires superhero stories and stories about the gods. Because when you think about it, isn't mythology just ancient times superheroes?
Yeah, people like to say that.
They do like to say that a lot. And, you know, he starts just rattling off. There's been so many, like, horrible disasters in Philadelphia lately. There was that plane crash and that hotel fire. And every time one of those happened, he was watching the news, waiting to hear one specific combination of words. There was only one survivor, and he was miraculously unharmed. And now he's had it.
David thinks this is some sort of scam, and eventually he'll ask for his credit card number.
Yeah, he's like, listen, I get, you know, con artists work their mark by telling them things they want to hear, pumping them up, making them feel good, and eventually they're going to want something.
But, like, what would the scam be here? He's waiting for someone who survives a horrible accident? There's not that many of those.
I mean, I guess in the world where he is purely a shuckster, it's he made that whole backstory up in response to the news story, right?
I guess so, yeah. But he wouldn't have been able to make up his whole house that supports his story.
Yeah, that's true. Joshua, much, you know, taking after his father, also looks like he's constantly on the verge of tears.
He just wants to connect to his papa.
He just wants to connect to his papa, and he kind of, like, fully buys Elijah's theory hook, line, and sinker right away. Like, oh my god, my dad's a superhero. My dad could beat up your dad.
Turns out the person who most appreciates Elijah's theory is a child.
Yeah. Also, the way Elijah talks, like, during this conversation, Joshua was just like, oh no, Dad got injured, he got in a car wreck. And Elijah just goes, is what the child says true? Fuck you.
He talks like a supervillain.
He is just, like, the most unpleasant person, and, like, I'm, like, good, like, I like it that he's unpleasant, but he sucks so bad. Also, just, the, yeah, again, good fashion, love his hair in this movie also.
Yeah, it looks good.
Got a cool-looking, kind of, like, asymmetrical hairdo into it.
Asymmetrical, almost as if there's something off about him.
Something a little askew. At home, David is, like, rifling through his closet. He isn't looking for his gun, but he does find it briefly, just because we gotta set up that Chekhov's revolver for a little later. And, then he, you know, pulls down a folder he's got, just sort of tucked away, of all the newspaper clippings that have been written about him. And it's all about, like, his, college football career. And, you know, oh, he's born to be a champion. But the last clipping in there is about the car wreck he was in. Oh, dang.
Ended his football career.
Yeah. Because that's the other thing, too, right? Like, you know, Mr. Glass kind of tells him, like, oh, so you got hurt in that car wreck. Okay, I guess, maybe I'm wrong about you. But David knows full well he didn't get hurt in that car wreck.
That's right. That's what puts the worm in his brain.
Yep. And then his wife shows up at his door. Again, they've got separate bedrooms. It's like, this is the second time where one of them had to, like, knock on each other's bedroom door to, like, why do they even have an apartment with this many bedrooms in it?
I think this is a house.
Sure, it's like a townhouse.
It's only three bedrooms.
I guess so. Yeah, that's true. But she just kind of tells him, you know, listen, it won't affect me either way. I don't care. I just feel like I need to know. Since we've been having problems, have you seen anybody? It's totally fine if you have. I don't care. And then he says no, and she immediately starts sobbing. It's a good scene.
It's a really good scene. I think their interactions are the best part of the movie.
Yeah, you might be right about that. Yeah.
But she says she wants to rekindle their relationship because it has to mean something that, like, he's the only survivor of the crash. There has to be some sort of sign.
Right. So she just wants, like, why don't we just start from a totally fresh slate? Why don't you just take me out on a date sometime and we, like, try to rebuild from scratch? And, again, this is about the point where I realize, like, David makes, like, almost no, like, proactive choices in this movie at any point.
Right.
He's just like, okay, yeah.
He says, I think, exactly one word in this conversation.
Yeah, just no.
And even when he closes the door, he doesn't seem to have, like, a reaction on his face.
Right, he's just the same exact, like, maybe about to cry, but is just holding it together that he has for his entire life.
Right.
Like, the only real proactive decision he makes, up to this point at least, is, you know, when he takes the wedding ring off to flirt with that woman, and it, like, he's so bad at it.
Right.
Elijah
shows up to his work.
Yeah, Elijah shows up to hassle him at his job, because he mentioned that he was a security guard, and that got Elijah's attention again. Like, out of all the careers you could have chosen, you chose one where you protect people. Isn't that interesting?
I think it's funny that, he's able to track him down here, because he didn't just say he was a security guard, he also told him exactly where he works.
That's true.
Which felt to me like maybe he's intentionally letting this slip. He's kind of hoping that Elijah will show up.
And again, like, Elijah's argument is extremely weak. Like, you're just a natural born superhero, so of course you were, like, drawn to a job that would be a protector, a guardian. Like, what? That's stupid. Everything Elijah says is stupid.
Why is that stupid?
Because, like, it's a security guard. You're not, what are you talking about?
Don't security guards protect people?
I guess so.
Within the tropes of a superhero story, security guards are usually good guys.
I totally agree, but again, that's where I kind of thought the movie was gonna be at, and where I sort of wish it was like, yeah, within the tropes of a superhero story, Elijah makes sense, but this isn't a superhero story, so, like, can you really buy all this? And, like, maybe it all adds up to point in a certain direction, but I don't know. And I, like I said, I wish the movie didn't come down so conclusively on Elijah's right about everything. In part, because again, Elijah's the villain, his, like, worldview sucks, and I don't love that the movie kind of just fully vindicates him.
Well, is Norman Osborn correct for engineering a super spider because it created Spider-Man?
No, but Norman Osborn didn't engineer a super spider because he wanted to create a Spider-Man.
He wanted someone to have superpowers. Him.
I don't know why he made that spider.
He wanted himself to be a super guy.
Sure. But, like, it's more about, like, less... You know, obviously, the movie is, like, not taking Elijah's side morally. It's bad that he killed so many people. But it's taking his side in, like, the way that he, like, views the world, his framing of it, his understanding of it. That's correct. He's just on the wrong side of it morally. And everyone that thinks that, like, his way of looking at things is ridiculous is just, like, fully disproven.
Yeah, this movie believes in superheroes.
This movie believes in superheroes. And I'm just saying, I kind of would like a version of this movie that was more, not even, like... didn't believe in superheroes, but maybe was more agnostic about it, or more, like, left it more of an open question.
Yeah.
Like, left you to really, like, I would love it if this was a movie that you walked out of arguing with your friends about whether Bruce Willis was really a superhero or not, you know?
You want the Inception top.
Sure, yeah.
But you don't like the Inception top.
I don't like the Inception top because I don't think it suits that movie.
Right.
Because that movie's all about how... No. The answer to this question is extremely important. We can't, like, we need to know the answer of it, so to leave it at, well, who knows? Like, and it's not, yeah.
But now you're arguing the opposite for this movie.
I do want the opposite for this movie. while Elijah's at work, while he's at with David at work, he, like, sees a guy in, like, a camo jacket. He kind of, like, bumped into him a little bit, and he decides he's going to start doing pat-downs because he thinks that guy might have a gun. You know, probably, you know, it's just a hunch, probably because he's got that camouflage jacket on.
It's good to be a paranoid security guard.
I got a picture in my head of a silver handgun tucked into the back of his pants, like in a movie. So after they part ways, Mr. Glass sees that guy and starts following him. And it's, like, I guess technically a chase scene, but, you know, Mr. Glass can't run.
No, but he does believe in this so much that he's willing to break every bone in his body just to confirm the gun.
Well, he starts, he's walking after this guy. He's kind of shouting at him. The guy doesn't even really seem to acknowledge him. He's not trying to, like, get away. And, you know, he just keeps chasing him. You get, like, a shot where the wind blows Mr. Glass's jacket and you see the purple lining of it. And again, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Brightest purple ever.
And the guy goes down a huge staircase, and Mr. Glass really doesn't want to go down these fucking stairs, but he does, and he keeps trying to go faster and faster, and he loses his balance and falls, and you see, like, his glass cane hit the stairs and shatter, intercut with him hitting the stairs. It's like, that tells you everything you need to know about what's going on with him internally. It's, hey, this M. Night Shyamalan fella might be pretty good at making movies.
He's good at filmmaking.
Yeah. And again, yeah, I guess it's sort of obvious or whatever, but it's effective.
But he finally catches a glimpse of the guy's gun, and it's exactly as David described.
Yeah, like, he hits the bottom of the stairs, and he is, like, ready to just start, like, sobbing in pain. He's just, like, can't move. But the guy hops the turnstile, and he sees the gun, and, like, all of, like, the pain just drains out of him, and he smiles because he was right.
He knows his place in the world.
Uh-huh. Bruce Willis gets home from work, and, like, his kid wants him to play football with all the other kids. There's a guy there who's, like, a cousin of somebody who's like, oh, he's, like, gonna be a pro. So, like, I didn't think about, this is the guy that the lady he was flirting with wanted to represent.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
I didn't put those pieces together, but that's who this guy is.
Huh.
Because David is like, yeah, I know, I've heard all about him.
Now that's a superhero EU right there.
Yeah, right? The Unbreakable side story where this guy's a hero. David wants to go work out, and his son decides to come with him and help. And the way he helps is by putting too much weight on the bar.
He keeps putting more and more weight on.
Yeah, they do. This is one spot where I think the cinematography maybe gets a little too cute, where, like, David kind of, like, chides him, be like, hey, you put too much weight on the bar, that's dangerous. And his kid's like, oh, okay, I'll fix it, Dad. And you just get a long shot of, like, Bruce Willis and the, like, what do you call it? Barbell? Is that what this is called? Yeah. It, like, kind of extends off the frame in both directions. So you keep seeing this kid walk out of frame and you hear, like, weight shuffling around. And then he goes to lift it and, like, oh, it's even heavier now because he didn't take weight off. He put it on. It's like, well, okay, Bruce Willis would have seen that, though.
But the whole scene, he doesn't know how much weight is on it. He has to keep asking.
Right, yeah. But I'm just saying, like, the way that he uses, like, a camera trick to hide that from you felt a little, like, all right. I'm mostly with you, but relax a little bit here.
Eventually, he even starts hanging paint cans because they ran out of weights.
Yeah, they do a lot of cycles of this where he, like, you know, can lift a little bit more than he thinks he does and a little bit more and a little bit more. And yeah, eventually he's bench pressing 350 pounds.
And he's struggling every time, but he keeps doing it.
Yeah, it's almost like he, like, it's not that he can just go, like, pick up a bus. It's like he can, it's almost like his muscles just, like, heal and grow way faster than a normal person's.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's, you know, Bruce Willis, big strong guy.
Meanwhile, Elijah's in the hospital, the doctor's talking to him, and all he can say is, the kids called me Mr. Glass, because he's thinking about how maybe he's a supervillain.
The kids used to call me Mr. Glass.
And he has to go to the physical therapy. Turns out, Audrey's his physical therapist.
Yeah, and they never really established, is this, like, a coincidence that he took advantage of, or did he somehow I guess he must have, like, insinuated himself into her care somehow, although I don't know how he would do that.
I did physical therapy recently. Like, you can pick where you go. He could probably find out where she worked.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. And yeah, like, he starts asking her a bunch of questions about her relationship, and just starts prying more and more, hearing more about the car accident. And he learns from her that, you know, she probably wouldn't have gotten with David if he had continued his football career, because in many ways, football is the opposite of what I do.
Football rewards you for hurting other people.
Yeah. You know, football do kind of be the opposite of physical therapy.
But it's also keeps physical therapy in business.
It's a vicious cycle.
Just like supervillains keep the superheroes in business. Can't have one without the other, can
you? Right? You can't. But yeah, she's like, he eventually kind of like name drops David and she starts getting real like, ooh, this, no. And at work, David is deciding like, hey, you know, maybe that was a psychic vision I had. Maybe I need to start like seeing if I can, if this isn't just, you know, a gut instinct, maybe there's something to this. And who should he bump into but M. Night Shyamalan?
He thinks M. Night Shyamalan is dealing drugs at the stadium.
Yep. So he takes him and he pats him down, but nothing there.
So he was wrong on this one.
He was wrong on this one. What is the idea that maybe he just got rid of the drugs before this? Like, what is the in-story justification for this? Because Bruce Willis does have this power.
I mean, let me look at the clip now. M. Night Shyamalan's in the bathroom. He drops something in the trash can. No, he picks something out of the trash can.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just money.
Could have just been money. That's true.
Because all he saw is that he picked something out of a trash can. He doesn't know what it was.
Right. Yeah, the shot's too dark for you to tell what he's actually taken.
Also, it's not like his pat down's that thorough.
That's true. But I mean, I think he checks the pocket that he saw him, you know, put the thing into.
He could have changed pockets.
You could have changed pockets.
Could have put it up his butt.
Yeah.
Or maybe David's just wrong.
Maybe David's just wrong. Again, I would love if there was more ambiguity and he didn't, like, nail it perfectly the next time he tries this. I think maybe the idea, because Mr. Glass does say, like, you know, have you ever tried developing that skill? And maybe the idea is supposed to be that, like, you can get to the point where you can touch a guy and know everything he's done, but you're not there yet.
Right.
David has to leave work early because his son got in a fight. Because his son decided he should be heroic and defend a girl in his class from being bullied.
But he feels like he isn't heroic, not like his dad.
This, like, principal or guidance counselor, whoever, is the most... What's her fucking problem?
She's just old and reminiscing.
But there is such a creepy tone to the way she talks. And like, she's clearly upsetting David the more she goes on. And I'm like, oh, I remember you. I remember when you couldn't breathe in the pool and you almost died. The kids tell it like a ghost story now. Oh, but it keeps them out of trouble, doesn't it? You don't remember me? I was there when you nearly died.
David mentions that he usually doesn't come to the school for this stuff because Audrey handles all of it. So maybe she just hadn't seen him in a while and misses him.
Or maybe she heard that and was like, well, I'm about to ruin this dude's entire day because fuck that. Be a more present parent and maybe I won't re-traumatize you, idiot. But yeah, his son is explaining, like, you know, they just wouldn't stop picking on this girl, so I tried to get him to stop, and they just kept pushing me down and wouldn't let me get back up. I thought, because I'm your son, I'd be like you, but I'm not. And Bruce Willis just says, you are like me, I can get hurt like anybody.
We can both get hurt.
It's definitely, like, there's something to, like, you know, when you're that age, you're like, no, my parents are just, yeah, my dad can beat up anybody.
And Elijah Price told me he's invincible.
Right, like, I already assumed my dad could beat up anybody, and then a guy in a cool suit sent my dad an anonymous letter to let him know that he could beat up anybody. So clearly it's true.
Did you see how cool he looked? He's gotta be right.
But he is, like, at home, he's doing the dishes with his wife. Joshua's just sitting at the table. His wife's telling him about, like, she had to deal with Mr. Glass. And he's like, oh, god damn it. Okay, well, sorry, hon. And then Joshua pulls out a gun. Pulls out that very gun we saw earlier.
His plan is to shoot him to prove that he can't get hurt.
I like this scene.
It's really good.
Yeah. And again, this scene has the ambiguity I want out of this movie. We're like, the gun doesn't get, you know, shot, you know? We don't know what would happen if he shot him.
No.
Probably he'd just get hurt, right? But well, maybe.
He's able to defuse the situation by saying, you know what? Maybe it won't hurt me, but if you shoot me, I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna go to New York.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's just gotta, yeah, try to talk Joshua down. I like the line where, like, Joshua asks him why, and he goes, because I thought we were just finally starting to get to be friends.
That's a really good line.
It's a really good line. And then he kind of just pivots to doing the dad voice and giving him to the count of three, and that finally gets him. And they all, like, all three of them just kind of, like, collapse onto the floor once the gun is disarmed.
I really like this scene because this is the kind of thing that happens in a comic book or a movie or an exaggerated story. And, like, because he believes in Elijah's comic book view of the world, he's doing this dramatic things that you shouldn't do.
Yeah, yeah. And I love in, like, the next scene, Bruce Willis is, like, telling Elijah to leave him the fuck alone because of what happened. And Elijah's like, I never said you couldn't get shot. What the fuck? It's not my fault, your kid's stupid.
Oh, hold on. If he can survive a train crash, he can probably survive a bullet, right?
I mean, maybe.
I think, I don't know. Do train crashes or bullets cause more deaths?
I'm going to guess bullets just by virtue of the fact there's more of them around.
Because he basically has the same powers as Luke Cage, the bulletproof man.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, the fact that he got out of the train without even getting a scratch on him. That's the thing to me, like, hey, you know, Joshua, let's maybe not start at the gun. Maybe see if you can, like, nick him with the tip of a knife. Like, just kind of poke his finger with a knife and see if it bleeds.
Does David get vaccines?
Can David get vaccines? Well, he doesn't get sick.
So he's never gotten, like, a flu shot?
I mean, why would he need one?
Because, I don't know, you're just supposed to get one.
Right, like, did his parents not take him for, like, his shots as a kid?
Maybe they didn't. Maybe this is just, maybe if you're anti-vax, you get superpowers.
We finally found the secret meaning of Unbreakable.
Yes.
That's what it's been about all along. But yeah, Elijah is, like, grilling him about whether he actually got hurt during that car accident or if he faked getting hurt so that he could stop playing football to marry his wife. Because he thinks that's what happened.
And he tells Elijah that he almost drowned as a kid, so clearly he can get hurt.
Yeah. I had kind of wished that the car accident thing was less him. I kind of wanted him to actually get hurt in the car wreck, but have the thing be that, like, well, you got hurt because you moved to protect your wife. Of course, in a superhero comic, heroes are often injured while they try to, you know, save other lives. Like, look at Spider-Man's suit ripping. Look at Spider-Man's arms almost getting torn off as he stops that train in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, that would be good, because Elijah tries to present it scientifically, like, oh, there's simply something about your bones that makes it resistant. But if he presented it that way, it'd be more like, the world bends to the tropes of superhero comics.
Right, right. But yeah, he tells him about how he almost drowned, so clearly Elijah's just wrong, and this gives Elijah the deep supervillain depression.
He is so devastated by this revelation that he goes to one of those commercial comic book stores that he despises so much, and just gives the clerk a hard time.
He just wheels himself, because he's in a wheelchair, because his leg is still broken from falling down the stairs, and he just sits in the back of the shop and mopes. And the clerk is just trying to get him to leave. It's closing time. He wants to go home. I gotta get some chicken in me, man. You know what I'm saying? I love this clerk. He's great.
This guy shows up again.
Oh, does he?
According to Wikipedia.
That's incredible. And like, this is intercut with what's going on with Bruce Willis, but I think we just talk about the comic shop scene where, like, eventually the guy's like, all right, man, I'm just gonna wheel you out of here. You can go mope on the street. And every time, like, he keeps trying to just wheel him down the aisle, and Elijah keeps, like, jerking the wheelchair off to the side so he crashes into a display and knocks a bunch of comics on the floor. And the dude's getting more and more pissed. He's like, all right, fuck it. I don't care. I'll just call the cops on you. But then, Mr. Glass sees a comic book called, what is it, Sentry Man?
Yes.
And that gives him a flash of inspiration, and his depression is cured. Because he found a superhero trope that can explain the hole in his theory.
But Luke, isn't it fate that he happened to knock over this specific comic?
It must be. What else could it have been?
The only comic in the world that has superheroes having a weakness.
Yeah. But yeah, meanwhile, David and his wife, whose name
Audrey.
I don't remember, Robin Wright, Audrey, are going out on that date, and, you know, they're asking each other first date questions again. They find out that their favorite colors are brown and rust, respectively.
It's so good.
And then eventually his wife takes it to a realer place and asks him when was the first time you thought we might not make it as a couple? And he doesn't really want to talk about this, but eventually he caves and says that one night he had a nightmare and, you know, woke up from it, and he didn't wake her up so that she could comfort him.
That's rough.
Is it?
I don't know. Isn't it?
If I woke up in the middle of the night from a bad dream, I don't think I would wake up my partner so that they could comfort me. I think, like a grown-up, I would just be like, oh, that sucked. I need to go back to sleep.
But I think the implication is that they had had a habit of doing that.
Sure, I guess you have to assume that. Yeah, yeah.
Though I agree, don't wake me up if you have a nightmare.
Yeah, I'm, like, if I got woken up because Chelsea had a nightmare, I guess I would assume it must have been fucked up enough that, okay, no, she needs some comforting right now. But I might also think in the back of my head, like, it was a dream. You're good? It's all good. You're fine. I'll give it a pass because I like the way this comes back around at the end, but yeah, I think it's a little goofy. But yeah, they come home. I like this babysitter
this
a
babysitter
lot.
Is amazing.
This teenager's like, well, you got two phone calls. One of them went to the machine because I was on the phone. I didn't talk very long on the phone, though. I didn't use the phone too long. I wasn't just on the phone the entire time you were gone like a teen girl would be or anything.
Babysitting seems like such a good gig.
Probably depends a bit on the kid, but yeah.
Yeah, for this kid, you could probably even leave him alone.
Yeah, this kid's just gonna stare sadly at his superhero action figures all night. But the, the job that he interviewed for called him back, and they do in fact want to hire him, which means he can move to New York like he was planning to. But now, you know, perhaps he's rekindling his relationship with his wife. Is that what he wants to do anymore?
Audrey processes this, like, so fairly, like, oh, I know we're just getting started. I can't expect you to change your whole life just for something that might not even work out.
Yeah, I mean, we can, you know, maybe just do, like, a long-distance thing. It's not that long, you know, it's New York to Philadelphia. We can, you know, we'll just have to take it slower. And honestly, maybe taking it slower is the right thing to do. That's probably for the best, right? Okay, that's fine. I'm not upset. Bye. And he, again, just says nothing this entire time?
Right.
Right, that's the other part of the their date, is she asks him, you know, if he knows that he keeps her and Joshua at such a distance. And he's like, yeah. I don't know why. There's just, I don't feel right. Like, there's something wrong with me. And she, I think, very fairly is like, okay, well, if you're unhappy with the life you have, you know, it's entirely a product of the choices you made. You could, like, you're married to me because you wanted to be, so you could maybe act like it.
Right. Or you could be a superhero.
Or you could be a superhero.
And lie to me.
But yeah, the other phone call they got went to the message machine was Elijah calling up to be like, bro, I figured it out. I figured out why you got hurt that one time. It's because water is your kryptonite. You're impervious to everything except water. It affects you the same as everybody.
I guess even Luke Cage can drown.
Sure.
Doesn't have gills.
Yeah. Bruce Willis goes and kind of like looks around in the wreckage of the... He breaks into the warehouse where they're storing the wreckage of the train as he, like, studies it.
He's wearing his poncho.
Yeah, yeah, because it's rainy outside. Raining, water, but that's his weakness. Oh, no.
This is also Signs. Maybe he has got alien DNA.
And there's also, hey, eventually there's going to be a lady in that water.
And Aang learns water bending.
And Old is on a beach.
Yeah. And Cabin in the Woods is by a lake.
Someone probably drinks some water in that movie.
It's like the earth is 70% water.
Oh my god. we get the flashback to the car crash where, you know, young David, you know, uses his super strength to rescue Audrey from the car crash, and then when someone shows up to help them, you know, they're like, oh, are you hurt? And I think this younger actor does a pretty good impression of Bruce Willis's about to cry face.
Yes.
As he makes the decision that he's going to pretend like, yes, he is hurt.
Yes.
But he calls Elijah back up. He admits everything. He never got hurt in that car crash. At first, I thought Elijah was just still in the comic store after it closed somehow, but no. He just, the back room of his gallery basically just looks like a comic shop, because he's just a fucking liar. And he tells David to go among the people and find good to do. And you might notice at this point, those comic frames have kind of dropped away, because David Dunn is, even though he's embracing the comic book, you know, like, paradigm of the world, he's not boxed in the same way anymore.
Now he's open.
He's open. And he stands in the middle of a crowd with his hands extended like a messianic figure so that he can touch people and see all their sins.
Yeah, he sees a petty thief, a violent racist, a rapist, and a serial killer.
Yeah, it sure is a lot in a very short span of time.
That's the Philly. It's a messed up city.
I guess it's just the Philly. Again, part of it, so far the only time he's done this, he was wrong. Would have kind of liked it if this was just him making up stories about what kind of awful people in this crowd might be, you know?
But aren't superhero stories just a fantasy of what if those stories you made up were true?
Yes, totally. But like I said, I don't like that this becomes a full-on earnest superhero story is what I'm saying.
Yeah, this is in no way a deconstruction of superheroes.
Exactly. It kind of felt like one in the first half, and now that is just like, nah, don't worry about it. That's fine. It's all real. Yeah, the vision he gets of this guy in an orange jumpsuit is he just knocked on a dude's front door and just said, I like your house. Can I come in? And the guy's like, no. No, you can't.
This is such a fucking guy with Ring camera fear.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because, yeah, this guy just forces his way into the house, beats this man to death, kills his wife, and then, like, imprisons his three children and is implied to be, like, sexually abusing them. And David is, you know, horrified by this vision. He follows this guy home and sort of sneaks into the house. He frees the kids. As he's searching for the guy, he like goes out onto the balcony and the guy sneaks up on him and shoves him over the railing. And he lands and lands in a puddle of water. Oh no, that's his weakness. Wait a second. This puddle of water is on top of a tarp covering their pool. Even more water!
He falls into the pool and he can't get out because the tarp's in the way.
He's kind of like tangled up in the tarp. He's just sinking. And he has to like grab the like hose of the like filter or something to like pull himself out.
He manages to overcome his greatest fear and his greatest weakness.
He does, and he just kind of puts this guy in a sleeper hold, knocks him out, and then leaves him with the people he was victimizing.
And then I guess he just calls the cops, which he could have just done in the first place. But he is renewed by this act of righteous superheroing. And now he carries his wife into the bed and holds her and says that he had a bad dream.
Yeah. It's almost as if the bad dream was not just the nightmare he had that one night, but his whole life.
Yeah.
And he's finally awake from it.
Yeah.
And, then it, like, fades from that to the next morning when Joshua, like, comes downstairs and his, like, parents are sitting at the table smiling at each other, holding hands, and that's just got... It's clearly just not an energy he's used to or expecting at all. He's like, what the fuck is happening down here?
He very tremulously pours himself a glass of orange juice.
And David just sort of slowly slides a newspaper in front of him about a mysterious anonymous hero that rescued some children from a real fucked up guy.
And his wife says, hey, if Elijah comes around again, we should probably call the cops on him. Even though... David seems committed now to being friends with him since he was right.
Right. And he tells, like, Joshua, oh, don't tell your mom. You know, just kind of, like, silently puts a finger to his lips. Why can't he tell her?
He's a superhero.
But, like, why?
Superheroes always lie to their wives.
But, like, what motivation does he have?
Her wife, she doesn't like violence.
Yeah, but he protected people from violence.
But he also choked out a guy.
Who was, like, murdering people.
But, you know, what if he gets hurt or hurts someone else?
I guess so. I feel like it's real flimsy why he can't just be honest with her. But then, you know, we get into the ending of the film. They go to... David goes to Elijah's gallery showing. And, you know, he sees a comic book. And Elijah's mom comes up and does the same bullshit he does. Like, notice that the villain wears scary costume.
The villain has a slightly skewed perspective on the world because of his big eyes.
And David's like, I don't know, he doesn't look that scary to me. Oh, that's what I said to my son at first, and he explained to me that sometimes villains don't look scary.
There's soldier villains, but then there's also masterminds who fight the hero intellectually.
Hmm, I wonder what that could be foreshadowing. Elijah leads David back into the back room of his gallery. Again, it looks like a comic shop in here. And, you know, he's still in the wheelchair, but he's like, oh, well, sounds to me like it's about time you and I shook hands. And he reaches his hand out. And what I do love is that Elijah has, like, supervillain gloves. And it's not commented on at all. It's just he's wearing just, like, another, like, stylish leather jacket with a purple lining. But clearly underneath of that, he has supervillain costume. He showed up to this thing in his cosplay.
He wanted to dress nice when he was getting arrested. You gotta look nice for the papers.
Right, so he shakes David's hand, and we get the montage of all three of those disasters he kept naming. Well, heck, Elijah caused all of them. He's just sitting in the airport while everybody else runs to the window in a horror, and he's just sitting there silently.
In all these flashbacks, the color is very muted, almost black and white, except for his vibrant purple.
Yeah, everybody has like a signature color, and of course Mr. Glasses is purple.
Yes.
My favorite one of these is when he's at a bar with an old guy, and the guy's like, oh yeah, let me tell you, I worked in that hotel for years, and I know all kinds of secrets about that place. And Elijah's like, oh yeah, what kind of secrets? Well, for instance, if you set it on fire, it would burn.
It's not up to code.
Yeah.
A lot of buildings, turns out, not up to code.
And David is horrified. Mr. Glass knows exactly what he did. He's like, you know, he wants to tell David about who he really is. And David looks around and realizes he didn't need superpowers for that, because this room is full of all of the evidence of Elijah's crimes.
He's even got, like, supervillain monitors.
Right, he's got, like, blueprints and, like, pieces of bombs.
And anyone who walked back here would know something is up.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And hey, maybe David subconsciously noticed all this before he shook his hand.
Maybe, but that... no, he just psychically saw visions of everything.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because how could he have figured out the thing about the serial killer otherwise?
I like that one of the newspaper headlines says, it kills all except newborn. There's a typo.
Oh.
That's a good detail.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, David is just horrified. You know, he thought Elijah was his friend. And Elijah explains, well, often in comic books, the arch-villain is friends with the hero. And at this point, David's just, like, walking away, like, I don't need to hear any more of this horse shit.
Now, his claim is that the villain and the hero are always opposites. Let's evaluate this.
Yes, sure. Well, I think, you know, what he is maybe, like, Superman, very strong. Lex Luthor, very smart.
Okay.
You know, Batman, a dark, scary guy who upholds law and order. The Joker, a funny clown that does chaos and crime.
The Green Goblin.
Spider-Man, poor working class doing his best. The Green Goblin, rich fucko.
Magneto.
That's, yeah, they're not quite opposites, I guess. They're more like ideological opposites.
Who's another villain? Dracula and Blade.
Good vampire, bad vampire.
Okay. One uses swords and one uses fangs.
Yes, exactly. I also like that as David's walking away, it like freeze frames and we get title cards like you'd get at the end of like a biopic or like, you know, a true story. Like David, like, you know, Elijah Price went on to get arrested for his horrible crimes. It reminds me of, have you ever heard that about like the like censored version of Fight Club that they did in China?
Yeah, where they said, don't worry, they all got arrested and justice was done.
Right, like it cuts out like a little bit before the movie, like before the bombs go off, and you just get a title card that says like, Tyler Durden was arrested just before he could detonate the bombs. He is now recovering in a mental institution.
So it's kind of a bittersweet ending where finally Elijah feels at peace with his place in the world because he knows he was born to be a supervillain.
Yes.
But only because he killed a million people.
Right, he could have just not done that.
But then he wouldn't know his place in the world.
Yeah. But someone needed to show him, like, listen, Iron Man has, like, a physical disability that he overcomes and becomes heroic. Or, like, Daredevil, his disability is a superpower, Elijah. Why didn't you follow those templates for what you were doing?
Is there a superhero with brittle bones?
Probably not, but I'm just saying, there are superhero stories about how, like, some kind of horrible, like, thing that the person has to live with becomes, like, if not the source of their power, like, a thing that they overcome to do heroism, as opposed to, well, I will simply kill people until a hero emerges.
If he was born a little bit later, and he was a gamer, and he played Mass Effect, he would be like, I could be like Joker.
I could be just like Joker! Yeah, that's the only other brittle bone guy I can think of off the top of my head.
But not like the Joker.
No.
He could have been a worse supervillain, you know? At least he chose to be, like, Ozymandias.
Right, I did my whole evil plan for the better of everybody. And sure, yeah, I'll like, give myself up now that I've achieved what I want. I don't care.
Well, that's unbreakable.
That's unbreakable. Like I said, I think good movie. I feel like the first half of it was maybe priming me to expect it was going to be an even better movie than it was, which made it a little disappointing at the end, but it was still good flick.
What rating would you give this flick?
I'm feeling like A-.
An A-. That makes it exactly as good as...
I hate every time you do this.
The Matrix Resurrections.
Matrix Resurrections. Yeah, yeah, that sounds right to me.
Spider-Man 1.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Hulk.
Yes.
And better than every MCU movie.
Oh, easily. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What would I give this? I'd give it a B+.
Yeah, yeah, that seems reasonable.
Luke, what movie are we doing next?
Next, we're watching the film Split, which I have never watched before.
I've also never seen it before.
All I know about it is that some people say, oh, fun, like, you know, horror movie, kind of, you know, little, not campy is the wrong word, but, you know, just kind of a fun spook 'em up. A lot of people think, ooh, pretty disrespectful about certain types of mental illness.
Hey, you know what is common in superhero fiction?
Yeah. And yeah, that's the thing I know, is that it's like a horror movie where the plot twist is that it was a sequel to Unbreakable the whole time.
That's right. It's the first stealth sequel. Is there another one?
There must be.
I can't think of one.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. Well, I looked up stealth movie sequel and I got Stealth 2.
TV Tropes so. Stealth sequel. Let's go to films live action. Star Trek 2009.
Sure, it's a stealth sequel to the original Star Trek because it's timeline. That doesn't count.
21 Jump Street is a sequel to the TV series because Johnny Depp suddenly shows up.
Okay, these are bad examples.
Yeah, these are all within the same series.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you gotta... Yeah, they're all like this.
Savage Vengeance to I Spit on Your Grave? That might work.
Okay, sure. I don't know enough about either of those films. I'm scrolling.
Oh, Tokyo Drift and Better Luck Tomorrow.
What's Better Luck Tomorrow?
That's the movie that he did before he got into the Fast and Furious that has Han in it.
Wow. Okay, yeah. That counts, absolutely.
I guess there's a couple.
Yeah.
Luke, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at SSJSpeedRacer. You can find other shows that I do on AudioEntropy.com, primarily Eidolon Playtest, an award-winning actual play podcast. I GM two different campaigns, Eidolon Disco and Eidolon Ska. It's about mystery-solving teens who also have superpowers. What? Oh, much like the Unbreakable Man. What if instead of just being unbreakable, you had, like, a funky little ghost that came out of you that made you unbreakable?
Huh.
That's what Eidolon Playtest posits.
Yeah.
I'd say Jordan is a Mr. Glass-esque villain.
He's not as stylish as Mr. Glass.
Nowhere near as stylish, no. He is the virgin to Mr. Glass's Chad, but much like Mr. Glass, he has a framework of the world inspired by the media he's consumed that he tries to force other people to adhere to.
Instead of superheroes, he likes detective fiction.
He likes literary fiction.
Like you might find on a middle school reading list.
Right. Yeah, he's very big-brained and well-read. He's read everything off of the AP reading list.
He's only 17.
Right. But yeah, you know. You can also find me on My Wife, She Loves That Reprise show. Speaking of detective stories, we're talking Columbo over there.
Hell yeah, that's a great show.
Hell yeah, love a Columbo. How about you, Crystal?
You can, of course, find me on Eidolon Playtest on the Ska campaign and on the Book of Matoya podcast, the latest sub-series of the Book of Medora podcast. Usually we talk about Zelda, now we're talking about Final Fantasy.
I hear Final Fantasy II is a good video game.
Final Fantasy II, deeply underappreciated video game. Everyone says, oh, this is the bad one, but it's actually really smartly designed.
I feel like the only thing I've ever heard about Final Fantasy II is either everyone underrates it, it's actually really good, or, wait, which one was that? I don't remember.
Or if Brad Shoemaker's talking about it, he's like, oh, do you mean 2 or 4?
Yeah, if anybody over the age of 40... You just can't talk about Final Fantasy with them.
Moby Games lists Final Fantasy IV as Final Fantasy II, and it pisses me off.
Yeah, that's irritating.
And Backlogged has a Final Fantasy II and a Final Fantasy IV entry.
For Final Fantasy IV, you mean?
Yes.
See, now, is the two entry listed as like... The way... There shouldn't be separate entries, but it should be Final Fantasy II parentheses IV.
No, it's just Final Fantasy II, parentheses, 1991.
The same way you would do, like, fucking, like, when you have a reboot of a movie and you, like, people refer to it with the year after it. You know what I mean?
Right.
It should have the real title, like, in parentheses.
Exactly.
Like, I can get it in the sense that, like, because FF6 is FF3. When they've released it as FF6 in America, did they, like... I assume they maybe touched up the localization or something, right? So strictly speaking, Final Fantasy III US is not the exact same piece of media as Final Fantasy VI US, you know what I mean?
But if you're going down that road, then you need to list each version of every game separately.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Because the WiiWare and the Steam versions of Final Fantasy IV the after years are not the same game.
Right, totally. No, I agree. Even if they were, the experience of playing on the Wii U is different than the experience of playing on your personal computer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear a break joke?
Sure.
It comes in from joke.museum/pages/break-jokes. What does it take to break a Nokia phone?
Dropping it from a moderate height.
A Microsoft.
Got him.
It's so true, though. Do you remember how Microsoft has bought like 700 game studios and hasn't released a video game?
They have less games than the PS5, a system with no games. But they're making another Xbox!
They're making another one!
The funniest fucking thing in the world to me was that week where there was like, oh, there's some big Microsoft news coming out. And like every game news outlet and a bunch of people on Twitter were just like, oh, they're probably announcing that they're not going to make consoles anymore and just make Game Pass like on PlayStation. That makes a lot of sense. They've really dropped the ball. They're not any good at making consoles. They should probably cut their losses. And they're like, oh, well, we're making another console, actually. So.
And then everyone's like, oh, false alarm. They're only porting over the cool games that people like and not shitty games that nobody likes, but they're really expensive to produce.
Right. Yeah, boy. I keep seeing people be like, I think maybe we're, might be due for a video game, like, industry crash. I'm like, guys, I think that started last year.
Yes, when money's no longer free.
I'm reading a new story about, like, 100 to 300 layoffs every week.
It's rough.
I think the crash has already happened. And I sure hope there's at least one sole survivor that will save us.
Lies of P.
That's the unbreakable game.
Lies of P 2, starring Dorothy.
Which game is the Mr. Glass? Which game has caused all of this?
What was the first loot box game? Mass Effect 3?
Yeah, that's an early one. My gut, I knew it wasn't the first, but like Overwatch, I feel like was a big like tipping point for them.
Hearthstone?
Hearthstone, definitely up there. Yeah, so it sounds like maybe Blizzard Entertainment is to blame.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? Ice. Blizzards have ice in them, and ice kind of like glass.
That's true.
Hmm? Think about it.
Well, anyway, until next time, I'm thinking of a sign-off. Keep breaking.
Keep breaking.